Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Shauna Shapiro, who is a tenured professor of psychology at Santa Clara University, a licensed clinical psychologist and an internationally recognized expert in mindfulness. She's the co-author of the critically acclaimed book, The Art and Science of Mindfulness, Integrating Mindfulness into Psychology and the Helping Professions. And she's here to talk today about the IAA model of mindfulness, the integration of mindfulness into psychotherapy, the evidence behind the effectiveness of mindfulness, and how all this might relate to the middle way. Hello, Shauna. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hi. Thank you, Barry.
Okay. Well, could you maybe start by telling us a bit about your background and how you first became interested in mindfulness?
So my father is a meditator and a professor of psychology, as well as my mother. And when I was young, they introduced me to meditation when I was quite young, about 5 years old.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I was 19 and I read Wherever You Go, There You Are by Jon Kabat-Zinn that I really felt the teachings come alive for me. And it was one of those experiences. I was reading the book and I was living, I was doing a national outdoor leadership training program in the wilderness. So I was living outdoors in nature for the first time in my life and also meditating for the first time in my life. And I realized that these teachings brought more peace and more ease and more joy than I had ever known doing anything else in my life. So I wanted to study them. So when I came back, I was at Duke University at the time and I was studying psychoneuroimmunology. And I realized that I really wanted to focus on mindfulness and psychology was the closest thing to it. So that's how I decided to get a PhD in psychology.
So did you see a real synthesis between those two approaches in a way?
I did. I was really, I wasn't religious by any means, and I certainly wasn't Buddhist. And so what I was really touched by in the teachings of mindfulness is that the Buddha was really the first psychologist, and he was investigating the mind in a very objective way, and that the teachings really felt authentic in their offerings, that I could test them out in my life and in my own laboratory of my own body and my own emotions. And for me, that seemed really important as a young exploring teenager who, you know, I was indoctrinated with psychoneuroimmunology, and the teaching there was if you think bad thoughts, or you're depressed, or you're anxious, you're going to get cancer, or you're going to get sick. Uh-huh. And as a 19-year-old, that really worried me because I was feeling a lot of confusion and loneliness and doubt. And I was wondering, what do I do with those emotions? And here was mindfulness offering a way to be with all of our emotions without any judgment and to really value and honor that they were there.
Okay. Well, could you give us an overview of the IAA model of mindfulness?
Sure. So when I was exploring mindfulness and studying it, what I was really struck by is that psychology was understanding and interpreting mindfulness from a largely cognitive framework.
Yeah.
And my experience of the teachings of mindfulness was that although the cognitive attentional piece was very important, central, in fact, it wasn't all of mindfulness. Uh-huh. And so I developed a model that was a three-part model, a tripartite model of intention, attention, and attitude. Because the word mindfulness, you know, put simply, it means to see clearly, to see what's actually true in the present moment so that we can respond effectively. And to do this, we need to know how to pay attention. We need to be able to pay attention in the present moment. So attention is central. However, why we're paying attention, our intention, is also important. Otherwise, a sniper could be the most mindful person in the world just by means of paying attention. So why we attention, our intention, and then also how we pay attention, our attitude. Are we attending in a kind, curious, open way instead of a judgmental, striving, rigid way? And so these three pieces of mindfulness, intention, attention, and attitude, all feel equally important. And that if you're practicing just attention in the present moment, from my perspective, it's not mindfulness. Or if I'm practicing just kindness, but there's no presence or awareness, it's not mindfulness. And so all of these are important.
Okay. You also see mindfulness as a very embodied process. Is that right?
Absolutely. That was the other piece. As I was studying in psychology and mindfulness was becoming popular, I was seeing how, again, it became very cognitive and very mental and not very embodied. That when you look to the original teachings of mindfulness, this is an embodied practice. It is recognized that mindfulness is to be practiced moment by moment while you're walking, while you're sitting, while you're lying down, while you're eating, and that the wisdom and the quote data is what you'd say from scientific lens in the body, the data in the body that we're attending to is what's guiding us. So our emotions, they exist in the body. You can't think about your emotions. You have to feel your emotions. And so what mindfulness does is it allows us to start to become more intimate with our body, to actually feel our body instead of living from the neck up, and to embrace the sensations we're experiencing, even if they're unpleasant, even if they're, you know, bubbles of anxiety or tightness of fear or a heaviness of depression. We learn to know our body.
It's interesting that you mentioned wherever you go, there you are, because that was the book that first got me interested in mindfulness myself. Before that, I'd had this sort of erroneous view of meditation as something as detaching yourself in many ways from your physical experience, that it was something otherworldly. And that when I came across that book and saw it was the opposite, basically, that it was grounding yourself in an experience, I thought, well, this is something that's worth trying, and I've not looked back, really.
I really love what you're saying, and I think it's actually a common misunderstanding of meditation and mindfulness that we think we're supposed to detach.
Yeah.
We're supposed to empty our mind of thought and not really care so much, like, oh, it's just depression, but depression isn't me, so it's no big deal. Or those are just my thoughts, and my thoughts are not me, so they're no big deal.
Yeah.
And I think that that's actually there. That's a certain danger in meditation, is that people become detached and disconnected. Meditation is about intimacy. It's about actually going into your experience, not detaching from it. In fact, Suzuki Roshi says, enlightenment is intimacy with all things. That the intention behind mindfulness is to actually know what it feels like to be sad, know what it feels like to feel joy or to be in love, not to separate ourselves from it, but to actually go deeply into it. And it gets confusing because we are trying to see clearly, we are trying to see objectively. So there is a sense of what's called disidentification or decentering, where we actually are able to stand back and kind of have a metacognitive awareness of our experience, where we're actually witnessing it. But at the same time, we're in the experience. And so you have this kind of dual experience of being completely absorbed, which is a non-dual experience, and then also at the same time being able to witness it with clarity and objectivity. So there's this beautiful dance between the duality and the non-duality, which is what we're always living our way into.
So what role does incrementality play in this approach?
What's interesting is there's kind of a paradox in mindfulness where, on the one hand, people are drawn to it because they're trying to achieve a certain goal. So in the West, especially, we're teaching mindfulness in hospitals and education systems, and patients come because they want to reduce their panic attacks or decrease their depression. So there's on the one hand, this sense of I'm going in a certain direction.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, mindfulness is a moment-to-moment process. And we learn in bite-sized moments of experience. And when we get attached to the outcome or the goal, or we begin to strive, we're no longer practicing mindfulness. And so it's really important, I believe, to set your intention, you know, set the compass of your heart in the direction that you want to go, and then you let go and you yield and you surrender to your experience in the present moment. And you really cultivate the capacity to trust that where I am right now is where I'm supposed to be, to trust that I'm learning and growing at just the right pace for me.
Okay, no, that makes sense. Yeah. Although you obviously acknowledge mindfulness's association with Buddhism, you also stress the universal nature of it, and that as a phenomenological practice, you see it as embedded in many religious and philosophical traditions. Could you expand on that a little bit more?
Absolutely. I think it is so essential for people to understand that mindfulness is not simply a Buddhist practice. Mindfulness exists in all of the world religions. It's part of the perennial wisdom of this universe, and it's an innate human capacity. You know, it's not a Buddhist capacity. It's a human capacity. This ability to pay attention in the present moment in a kind, discerning way is part of what it means to be alive, and that all human beings have this as their birthright. And really the practice is about remembering. When I'm teaching, I watch as people, there's a resonance, and I watch as they remember. It's not that they're necessarily learning something new or that I'm teaching them something extraordinary. It's that I'm reminding them of something that they already know. And the truth of it is so magnetic and so captivating and so authentic that they can't help but be drawn to it.
Okay. Can you now talk a little bit about integrating mindfulness into psychotherapy?
So I have devoted most of my career to the integration of mindfulness into psychotherapy and the helping professions. Linda Carlson and I wrote the book, The Art and Science of Mindfulness, with the specific intention of creating a graduate textbook so that I could use it to teach my classes, because I was training therapists and I was really needing a textbook. The reason I believe mindfulness is so exquisitely applicable to the helping professions is, first, it trains us in the very capacities we need to be good therapists. Mm-hmm. It trains us in empathy. There's been empirical quantitative research that shows that training in mindfulness increases empathy and compassion, which are the hallmarks of a good therapist or a good physician. It trains us in how to pay attention. If we're trying to do psychotherapy, I don't care how many years of schooling you have, if you are not able to pay attention, if your mind is wandering off, you're not going to be a good therapist. You're not going to be effective. It also teaches us how to be with strong emotions, mm-hmm. how to regulate our own affect and to help regulate others. Because with mindfulness, we learn to sit in the middle of strong emotion. We don't try to get rid of them or make them better or happy. And then the second reason, that's kind of the first pathway why I think it's important, is because it just cultivates the qualities we need to be therapists. But the second pathway is that it's an incredible self-care stress management tool. And all of the literature shows that therapists who are stressed are not effective. Physicians who are stressed are not effective. They make more mistakes. They have worse outcomes with their patients. They have worse doctor-patient, therapist-patient relationship. And so mindfulness not only cultivates the very skills we need to be good therapists, it also reduces our stress. Right. Typically, those two things are at odds. So the hospital management says, well, we can't give our doctors more time off or our therapists more time off. We can't implement an exercise program to reduce their stress because it takes away from patient care time. But with mindfulness, you're kind of, you know, you're hitting these two important pieces with the same tool.
Okay. You mentioned there the empirical evidence with regards to empathy. Could you just maybe expand a bit more in terms of how mindfulness-based interventions on people with psychological problems, what the evidence is there to suggest that it is effective?
Yeah, there's been about 40 years of research demonstrating the efficacy of mindfulness-based interventions for a variety of mental health issues. And what I would say is mindfulness is not a cure-all, right? It's not a magic pill.
Yeah.
And yet the data show that there are some significant clinically relevant effects. Mindfulness has been shown to decrease panic attacks and anxiety. It's been shown to decrease depression and to prevent depressive relapse in people with major depressive disorder. It's been shown to decrease behavioral problems such as substance abuse, binge eating, insomnia. And it's also been shown to increase mental well-being, increase mental health. And some of these studies, you know, show that mindfulness increases our sense of self-efficacy, which is the number one predictor of behavior change.
Right.
It increases our sense of control, our sense of happiness. It increases our spirituality and our spiritual experience, our compassion for others, but also our self-compassion, which I believe is a very important piece of mental well-being.
Do you think the mindfulness practice within a medical model has any limitations? For example, while psychotherapy is quite patently in many ways an ethical undertaking, secular mindfulness often comes across as somewhat unhooked from its arguably ethical framework.
This is one of the most compelling questions of our time, I think, with regards to mindfulness, is does the context matter? So as you're saying, when it's taught within its religious, cultural context, there is a whole frame of ethical conduct that goes with it.
Mm-hmm.
You must take the precepts of non-harming and speaking truth and not stealing before you're even taught the meditation practices. Whereas in the West, for very good reason, they've tried to make this a universal practice that transcends religion and culture. But in doing so, we've lost to some extent the context, and we've lost to some extent the emphasis on ethics and ethical conduct. And I have mixed views on how to approach this. Mm-hmm. I do believe that the mindfulness practice in and of itself is powerful enough to move people in the direction of ethical behavior, so that without even speaking of making good moral decisions, by just becoming more present and more compassionate with yourself, you start naturally inclining in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So I published a study with Horia Jazari in, when this was maybe 2012, we published this study where we taught college freshmen mindfulness-based stress reduction. I was the instructor. I never mentioned ethical behavior, didn't include any type of ethical context. I taught it in a very Western scientific model. And we measured the ethical decision-making of these college students to see if it moved in the direction of greater morality. And it did. So what was interesting about that was, without ever talking about ethics, just learning the practice had an effect. Having said that, I really believe in the power of intention. So
yeah.
I think creating a context where people know why they're learning this practice, and it's not just so that I can make more money or be a better CEO, but I'm learning this in part to cultivate my heart's natural compassion. In part, I'm doing this for others. I believe we don't just sit for ourselves. We sit for everyone. And so I'm curious if people are have intentions that are related to a larger whole, if that impacts the outcome of the meditation. And right now we don't know. There's no empirical research.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a scientist, so I stick with the data.
So in a sense, the IA model, you've tried to bring it within the intention aspect of it, ethics into that schema.
Exactly. I've tried to bring values into it. And I wouldn't say ethics, I would say values, because values are a little more, they're less charged.
Yeah.
And they're a little more individually based, so that I don't apply my ethics code to my patients. I don't apply my values. I say, what are your values? What is most important to you? Let that motivate us in this time together. Let's get really clear on your intention. And then we don't do that just in the first session and never come back to it. Then as we begin to refine our awareness, we return to our intention. Has it changed? Has it evolved? Now that I see things more clearly, you know, a lot of people will come to me to reduce their anxiety or their stress. And then as we work together, they might say, you know, I really want to have a deeper relationship with my daughter, or I want to find more meaning in my work. And so their intention, what's most important, starts to evolve as they undergo what I call values clarification, which is, you know, from Steve Hayes, it's really just a deepening understanding of what do I really care about?
Mm-hmm. I actually did an interview with Stephen last week and he talked on that particular subject. So it's interesting to make that connection. If there was no evidence to suggest that mindfulness works, would you still do it, Shauna?
Well, it depends what you mean by evidence. So if there were no scientific empirical data that showed that mindfulness worked, would I still do it?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. When I started practicing, I was 19 years old and I didn't know about any of the empirical data and I practiced.
Yeah.
Not because of external evidence, but because of my own internal experience. I collected my own data. I was calmer and happier and clearer in my life as I practiced mindfulness than any other time. And I often say to my patients, I say, you know, don't do it because you have to do it. Do it because you want to do it. And if you don't feel like meditating for a week, try not meditating for a week and then let me know what happens.
Yeah.
And usually what happens is their life starts to get really chaotic and they start to feel anxious. And what they notice is when they meditate, they actually feel better during the day. They're actually more present, more alive, more awake.
So, what do you think the future holds? I mean, I'm just thinking about in the UK, for example, now mindfulness is getting into schools. We've recently had a group of members of parliament involved in a mindfulness study. Things seem to be happening. What's your feeling about such initiatives?
My feeling is yes, 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 yay, hooray. I'm delighted to see how mindfulness is being explored and pioneered in these different arenas. Mm-hmm. I think introducing it to our children into education is such a beautiful and powerful path to be exploring, and I'm really delighted by it. And I believe that the integrity of mindfulness needs to be maintained and that the scientific exploration needs to be upheld so that we don't just jump on this kind of bandwagon of hooray, it's working, but we really continue to be nuanced in our exploration and investigation of what is actually effective, what is most helpful and for whom and in what ways. Because I think it's an error to just start teaching MBSR to 5-year-olds.
Yeah.
I think we need to really be sensitive in exploring what is it about mindfulness that is effective, and developmentally, what is appropriate, and how can we best serve our children? How can we best serve our politicians? How can we best serve our patients? How can we best serve our lawyers, our businessmen? I don't see any arena in this life that mindfulness should be excluded from. And so for me, what's most important is the integrity with which it's offered and the embodiment of mindfulness so that the people who are bringing it to these different arenas have a deep understanding and a deep personal practice.
Okay, so it's in a sense a work in progress that we can all play a part in.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Well, my last question, Shauna, what is your understanding of the middle way and how do you think it might relate to what we've been talking about today?
So the middle way for me is this incredibly open, inclusive, loving, yet also disciplined and discerning, so that we don't err on one side of overindulgence, but we also don't err on the side of being overly harsh. And what it reminds me of, and I've been pretty immersed, is my recent book is called Mindful Discipline, and it's a book about parenting and discipline. And for me, the reason I wrote the book is I'm a single mother, and I have a young boy, and Jackson, my son, when his father and I got divorced, all of a sudden I was mom and dad at home, and my style has been historically permissive and loving and the traditional mother. And what started to happen is he began to run our household, and he became this little dictator who was really in charge.
Yeah.
And I realized that there had to be a way, there had to be a middle way where I could create boundaries and have discipline, but not forsake the love. And as I wrote the book and studied this area, what I learned is that creating boundaries and having discipline actually makes the child feel safe.
Yeah.
And actually provides the structure that their brain needs to develop and grow. And I find the same is true with mindfulness, that there's this middle way, that we need the love and the compassion, and we can't do this as like a militant, you know, act of will. We can't just force it. And yet discipline, it is a consciousness discipline. We're training our minds and our hearts and our bodies in how to be present in this particular way. And for me, what I learned is when I first started meditating, I took it on like I do everything, which is I tried to do it right.
Yeah.
And I tried to do it perfectly. And it became one more way that I was failing and one more opportunity to beat myself up. And what I realized is that that's one of the greatest dangers of mindfulness, is that we can use it to try to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And that mindfulness is not a self-improvement project. Our life is not a self-improvement project, right? It's our life is about living it. And it's about mindfulness is about self-liberation, not self-improvement. It's about freedom. And so what I've become much more attuned to is how am I using this practice to cultivate the pathways that I want to strengthen, to cultivate the pathways of compassion, not judgment. And that includes not judging myself. And so this middle way is really about finding the balance between boundaries and love, love and limits, finding the path of spaciousness and ease and spontaneity while also being disciplined and conscious and connected to where you're trying to go.
Okay, well, that's a great example, I think, Shauna. We have an expression in the society that the perfect is the enemy of the good, and I think you expressed that really well there. thank you very much for talking to me today, Shauna. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, you're so welcome. It was a joy.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.